Welcome to this afternoon's panel on accountability. I'm James Cooper, the Deputy Director for Economic Analysis in the Bureau of Consumer Protection. And moderating along with me is Andrew Stivers, who is the Deputy Director for Consumer Protection in the Bureau of Economics. So we're sort of like doppelgangers. I can't believe we're together on the same stage and not annihilating each other. But anyway, the symmetry is eerie. Anyway, so we're here today to talk about the concept of accountability. We have a great panel, and we have limited time. I'll just give very, very brief introductions. Their full bios are in our program. So right to Andrew's left is Marty Abrams. Marty is Mr. Accountability. He's really, no one has been involved in this or thought about this as long as he has. Currently, he's the Executive Director and Chief Strategist for the Information Accountability Foundation. Next to Marty is Dan Caprio. Dan is the co-founder and executive chairman of the Providence Group. He's an expert in transatlantic data transfer, and he used to be an advisor to Commissioner Urson Swindle here at the FTC. Next to Dan is Mike Hensey. Mike is a partner at the Hensey Law Firm, PLLC. And prior to that, he spent 18 years at Microsoft, where he was the chief privacy counsel. Going down next to Mike is Corinne McSherry. She is the legal director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Ari Ezra Waldman is next to Corinne. He is a professor of law and the director of the Innovation Center for Law and Technology at New York Law School. And then finally, at far end, is Karen Zakaria. She is the Chief Privacy Officer at Verizon. Again, so we have a great panel. What we wanted to do to kind of set the stage is ask Marty to tell us a little bit about accountability. Again, there's probably no one who's more associated with the notion or studied this longer than been involved in it longer than Marty. And so what I was hoping is if you could just briefly tell us about accountability. How does it differ from other approaches? You know, what does it really mean to a layperson?
So first of all, thank you to Andrew and to James and to the Federal Trade Commission for letting me be here today. Marcus was here yesterday. He did a very good job of laying out accountability. And so maybe he is Mr. Accountability, and I'm just the guy who's been doing this for 30 years. When I think about accountability, why is accountability important to individuals? It's because the highest and best use of data is creation of new knowledge. And the fact is, it's new knowledge that drives the innovation, which has distinguished the digital marketplace in the United States from digital marketplaces every place else. And by the digital marketplace, I don't mean digital advertising. While that's part of it, it's not really it. The digital marketplace is smart cars. The digital marketplace is personalized medicine. The digital marketplace is all of the things that we do with knowledge and data that we were not able to do so before. And the concept of digital knowledge and the knowledge creation drives what we refer to as inferred data. And inferred data is new data that comes out of the insights that come from discovery using data. And I can't think of another way of making sure that that's done in a legal, fair, and just way other than through the concepts of accountability and how accountability works. Think of the fact that accountability, as we have defined it since 2009, is really about organizations being responsible with what they do with data and then being answerable for being responsible. And both sides of that equation, both being responsible and answerable, are incredibly important. There was something called the Global Accountability Dialogue that met first in 2009. And it was the Global Accountability Dialogue that defined the modern concepts of accountability, which were laid out first by the OECD guidelines in 1980. And there are five essential elements of accountability. The first is that organizations have to self-assert that they're accountable have the policies to truly be accountable, those policies need to be linked to external criteria. As my friends at the Federal Trade Commission know, if you self-assert, you're then subject to Section 5 of the FTC Act. So no one should say accountability is a self-regulatory system. It's actually not a self-regulatory system. It's a system of organizational governance that then has oversight that goes behind it. The second essential element is that you have the mechanisms to put those policies into place. And those mechanisms include the things that we traditionally think about, such as education for staff, training, procedures, et cetera. But it also includes the concept of doing a risk assessment, and a risk assessment on what your use of data means to all of the stakeholders who are impacted by that data. Not just me as an individual, but all individuals, society as a whole. So organizations need to be able to do that risk assessment. The third essential element is that organizations now need to have an oversight process that goes along with all of the mechanisms that go into place to make sure that those mechanisms actually work. Part of that oversight process is oversight over those risk assessments to make sure that they're done with competency and done with integrity. So the fact is that the internal oversight process is separate from the process of doing privacy by design, for example. The fourth is that the word and knowledge and the understanding of the public are important, so you need to have a means for individual participation in the process. So it requires transparency, it requires access and correction where that's appropriate for the process. It requires that you listen to the voice of the people. It means that in some cases you do research on individual concepts and ideas. In some cases it means you bring in experts, but the fact is that you have to have the voice of the people. And the fifth is, and this is one of the most important, is you stand ready to demonstrate your accountable process. And by being able to demonstrate that accountable process, you're open for the type of criticism that allows you to know that what indeed you're doing with data is acceptable, it's legal, fair, and just. Now, there are a number of companies in this room that truly have embraced this concept of accountability. This morning, when it was mentioned privacy by design, organizations that do privacy by design are actually fulfilling one of the requirements of accountability. But if you were to say, are most companies at this point, have they embraced accountability? Do they even understand accountability? In our work, we find that most organizations have some of the elements of accountability, but for accountability to be fully effective, there needs to be a comprehensive program that has all of the pieces of accountability and understanding of how those pieces link together. As Marcus mentioned yesterday, the General Data Protection Regulation in Europe actually requires accountability, and within the law it has all the elements of accountability, but it never draws those pieces together. And until companies and organizations understand what it means to be an accountable organization and understand how they're going to report to the public on how they are indeed being accountable, then we'll always have this gap. So let me quit there and say that really what we need to do as part of improving the process is having a description for organizations of what it truly means to be an accountable organization.
Thanks, and I just want to just follow up just a tiny bit. So just again, and this is coming from someone as thinking as an economist, I hadn't really thought about accountability as a term of art in privacy as it is. Does accountability, is the teeth behind accountability ultimately some legal authority? And what does the notion of accountability add to, leaving aside, say, the GDPR, which explicitly requires it, but do you think about Section 5 or you think about other regulatory regimes throughout the world, what does the accountability add that perhaps illegal would be missing in current legal regimes?
So the ICO, which is the privacy regulator in Europe, had a meeting with 1,000 businesses on Monday of this week on what she is looking for in terms of privacy compliance over the next year. And she said to those folks, she says, if something goes wrong and we come into your house as part of an investigation of an enforcement action, The first thing we're going to ask you is for you to show us your comprehensive privacy program to establish accountability. For her, the first step in investigation is saying, let me see your program, let me understand your program. Spain amended their privacy law in 2011 to give the regulator the ability to reduce fines for organizations that were accountable if they had an oops and had something goes wrong and it's not a systematic mistake. So the fact is your own consent orders here at the FTC require organizations to be accountable. So you require that for organizations that have had an oops, but not generally for the market. So the fact is that accountability is about taking organizations to account. Part of accountability, I believe, is ex-ante processes, and maybe if we have time, we can discuss that later. But it's really about the requirement that organizations understanding what they're doing with data, understand the risks associated with it, mitigate those risks for other parties that are involved, and having the ability to describe that.
Thanks. Andrew?
So as an economist, I'm interested in sort of how the market interacts with this particular concept. You know, at the FTC, you know, we often look at the world as sort of trying to make markets work. And I wonder, Ari, if you can address or give us some thoughts on, you know, what is it about this particular set of responsibilities that Marty laid out that, you know, isn't part of or maybe it is part of the standard sort of accountability that consumer-facing firms, you know, always have to their customers. If they don't offer a product that, you know, consumers want at the price that they're willing to pay, then they're held accountable. So can you help us understand what else is going on here, if anything?
Sure. So thank you, first of all, for inviting me to participate, and thanks for everyone for coming. Thanks to the FTC and to our moderators, James and Andrew. I'm going to talk for a few minutes about why the market is incapable of adequately allowing consumers to hold companies accountable. And there are really three main reasons why. And after going through those reasons, I'm going to suggest a little bit about what we might do in order to address some of those gaps. The first reason are information asymmetries. Efficient and fair markets require awareness and information on both sides. Consumers need enough information to know if a salesperson is offering them a lemon or a bad product, or a massive data collection scheme is hiding behind a friendly interface. Instead, the digital marketplaces that we have are characterized by enormous asymmetries of information. Technology companies know every single detail about us. Their ability to marshal large data sets to identify unique and unexpected correlations in that data allows them to identify what they think we like or what they think we want to buy and tailor our online experiences. On the other hand, as Frank Pasquale has noted, we have very little background knowledge about how all of that works, what they know, how platforms use and gather, manipulate, and analyze our data. We don't know the correlations between our behavior on those websites and the ability of these companies to create virtual personas of us. Therefore, we don't really know what we're giving up in exchange for the convenience that the digital marketplaces or social networks provide. A second barrier to market solutions to this problem are psychological barriers to rational choice. Even if we did read those long and legalese privacy policies that so many people here today and yesterday have correctly dismissed as completely garbage, we couldn't adequately translate what we learn into a rational decision, as any neoclassical model would require. We are all susceptible to what psychologists like George Ainsley and David Labson have called hyperbolic discounting, or time-inconsistent preferences. That's our inability to adequately weigh the potential of future risks and rewards against the reality of current rewards. We are also terrible at what Dan Gilbert calls affective forecasting, or assessing our feelings about what will happen in the future relative to today. So if we can't adequately assess the potential of future risks as against the reality of current rewards, either convenience or some minimal reward of having your name having your name remembered or a cookie dropped on your computer, how are we going to be able to translate that into rational decisions about our privacy? That important point leads to the third reason why there's no market for privacy preferences and why the market can't solve these problems. In fact, the market is designed out by the technology companies themselves. We operate in online environments that are designed for us and, in fact, are designed to manipulate our autonomy and maximize our data disclosure. Design is a powerful force that constrains our behavior in a space, and you can't make fully rational choices when the environment doesn't let you. As Woody Hartzog has stated in his latest book, Privacy's Blueprint, the realities of technology at scale, and I'm quoting here, mean that the services we use must necessarily be built in a way that constrains our choices. Technology companies have their own agenda, and that is to collect as much data as possible. And as they are and the ones in charge of designing the environments in which we interact with them and with other people, it will always be designed in ways that facilitates their business success, not our needs or human flourishing. Design nudges us to behave in certain ways. They make us feel guilty when we don't engage, and leverages our innate desire for popular feedback, for that little thumbs up, and takes advantage of our attraction to bright, shiny buttons that says, click here and move on. The point is not that design is bad. The point is that when technology companies have control over design, we, who are their subjects, are not in a position to make fully autonomous, independent, free choices, even if we read, understood, and were able to operationalize the privacy policies that they offer us. Given this, technology companies know that there's little risk of users not choosing to share their data. Given the current legal regime, little risk that companies will be held accountable when users finally realize what happened and then voice their displeasure at being manipulated, as so many stories over the last couple of years have shown. So if the market can't solve these problems, what does real accountability look like? My concern with the approach of the five accountability elements that we've just seen is that it doesn't always hold up on the ground. My research focuses on how technology companies implement privacy laws on the ground, and a lot of times the responsibility for privacy compliance is, despite having, at least on paper, adequate systems, structures in place, audits and offices and so forth, all of the things that would meet all of the five requirements of the accountability regime, a lot of those responsibilities are outsourced to privacy technology vendors, to engineers who are there to create easily codable or easy to use solutions, supposedly easy to use solutions that are, in as a result, undermining the promises of privacy law. So what would a regime with real accountability look like? And I'll just list a few and then end here and we can move on. I think some of the things that have been said here over the last couple of days and in the commissioner's brief speech before this panel are correct. A legislative approach must shift the burden of protecting privacy from the user who can't protect her privacy to the company who is in a much better position to. A new legislative approach should deploy fiduciary obligations on technology companies, as Jock Balkin, Neil Richards, who is here, and Woody Hartzog, and myself, and others have argued, and permit private rights of action when data is misused. One of the problems that we've noted is that the FTC is understaffed. We need to up the FTC staff, but to exclusively rely on FTC enforcement when we take away private rights of action is going to be unreasonable. A legislative approach should incorporate purpose limitation and data minimization, which actually are some of the requirements of fiduciaries anyway. A new legislative approach would require technologies to be designed from the ground up in ways that chooses the most privacy effective design, most effective design possible with the most privacy protective design. The legislative agenda could also track the requirements of Sarbanes-Oxley and make technology companies' executives directly responsible for signing off on privacy assessments and hold them liable if they mislead the public or fail to incorporate privacy protections from the ground up. The only way we're going to make a company that has contrary business interests to privacy protections to take our privacy seriously is to hold them accountable. A regulatory approach should double down on design, and the FTC needs to put its muscle behind a consumer protection agenda that recognizes the manipulative power of design, as Woody Hartzog has argued. Based on my own research, the FTC needs to look into making sure that its audits are real and enforced and followed up, as opposed to permissive assessments that don't allow for any real feedback. A regulatory approach would consider executive public statements as part of a company's commitments to consumers, especially since highly publicized statements by highly publicized executives, maybe in front of Congress, for example, are far more likely to become part of consumers' decision-making processes than something hidden in a privacy policy. The FTC, as the commissioner noted, needs fining power and easier rulemaking powers to enforce legislation to ensure that companies' feet will be held to the fire.
Ari, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We do have a number of other panelists. If you could wrap up and we can move on. I apologize, but...
And these are just a few of the steps that we need to put real accountability.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Ari, and hopefully we'll be able to get back into that. But again, we have short time and several panelists. But I want to move to Karen next. And as we think about accountability, we've heard from Marty about what it is, what his key tenets are. We've heard from Ari about how the marketplace may not be and may not provide consumers with the level of privacy they want. There are reasons to think that may not be the case. So we see, as Marty mentioned, accountability is specifically a part of the GDPR. As lots of activities kicking around on Capitol Hill, thinking about, I forget who it was yesterday, one of the panelists said, you know, we've had our privacy moment this year, the U.S. has had it, and lots of legislations kicking around on Capitol Hill. What do you think the role of accountability should be in any sort of U.S. Legal regime?
Thanks for the question, and thanks for having me here today. I think in the U.S. we really are at a crossroads and we have two choices. One is we can continue along the path that we have where we have some state laws that are governing data breach and privacy. We have some federal sector-specific laws. We have some self-regulatory regimes. And then we have accountability programs in companies. Or we can say the time is now, we should have a federal privacy law. And I've been lucky enough to be in this job at Verizon for 8 years, and the entire time that I've been at Verizon, we've been advocating for a comprehensive privacy law. And many of the elements of what we think should be in the law really are intertwined with the accountability principles. I've sometimes described what should be in a federal privacy law as the equivalent to a really complicated maze. And there are different ways to get out of it, but you know, there's not just one path. So I'm not going to sit here today and say privacy law needs to have the following 162 provisions in it. But what I'd like to do is spend a little bit of time talking about some of the overarching principles, and in particular, how those interrelate with the accountability framework that we're talking about. So as I said, it should be a federal law. It should be comprehensive. It should apply to all players in the ecosystem with one federal regulator enforcing it, which would be the FTC. The law needs to be flexible. And why do I say that? We want to make sure that this law can apply to the technologies of the future, both the ones that we already know about, whether it's 5G, something that Verizon's rolling out, Internet of Things, or new services and products that none of us in this room could even dream of today. We also want to make sure that the law will take into account new approaches to protect privacy, and it's not so prescriptive that if we have new methods, companies can't adopt to those. So if a law included some of the things that Marty mentioned earlier, things like training requirements or risk assessments, that's exactly what the law should say. Companies should do risk assessments. But it shouldn't then specify how it does those risk assessments. Other accountability elements that should be in a law would include things like transparency and choice. Companies should be required to be transparent with their customers and to tell them the types of information that they're collecting and how they're using it. Companies should be required to give appropriate choices. A law should also include accountability elements like data security and data breach. Now, federal privacy law wouldn't have to include those if there was going to be a separate data breach and security law. So, you know, it could be one law, it could be two laws, but we should have a federal law that talks about those issues. A law should have safe harbor programs. Why is this important? We're dealing with some really complicated issues, and sometimes the better way to work out how companies should act and what best practices are is to let companies come together, companies across industries, company and advocates, but figure out what those best practices should be, include them in a safe harbor program that meets or exceeds the law, and then companies who follow the safe harbor program are deemed to be in compliance, similar to what we have today in the COPPA world. And then last but not least, I want to talk about oversight, another important element of any accountability program. Marty talked about making sure that companies have their internal governance structure in place. That is certainly an important element. And then we definitely need some kind of external oversight. And what we would recommend, as I said in the beginning, is that the FTC be the federal enforcer. It should have additional civil penalty rights subject to caps, and also that state AGs should be able to enforce it. And I think I want to conclude by talking a little bit about incentives. Companies like mine have every incentive to do the right thing by our customers. We know that customers are only going to buy our products if they trust us. And so from the very top of the house, the C-suite is very, very focused on customer trust and on privacy issues. But I do think that one of the reasons why it's really important to have a federal privacy law is to make sure that all companies are incented to do the right thing.
Thanks. Thank you, Karen. So, Corinne, to kind of follow up on, Karen's talking about what a federal privacy law and how accountability would work in something like that. I want to drill down a little bit onto the notion of transparency, and if there are any regulatory approaches you think that, you know, how important is transparency to making firms accountable, and are there any regulatory approaches to transparency you think make sense?
Sure. So. I think we could probably all agree that, you know, transparency is kind of job one. You can't have accountability until you have transparency, but I think it's important actually to drill down on what that means. It seems to me that a minimum, transparency means you've got a window into the actual practices of a company, what's actually doing as opposed to what it says in its policy, and is there actually a match between those things? But you need a little bit more than that. You need transparency into the ecosystem within which that company functions, because we all know that the data doesn't just stay in one place. It moves all around and is shared across many different companies depending on the industry. So you need to have a window into that ecosystem. And these are all interrelated, you need to have a window into the actual nature of the risk. So if I'm a consumer, it's very difficult for me to assess. This is part of the sort of choice problem. It's very hard for me to even know what I'm choosing and what my risks are and what the risks are for my data. If I go to Target and I use my Target card or whatever, I know that they know what I buy. Do I know what they're doing with that information? Do I know who they're sharing it with? Do I know what they can infer from that information? Like they can infer that I'm pregnant or that I'm not or whatever, I'm alcoholic, whatever it is. Am I thinking about all that? Probably not, and it's probably going to be hard for me to do that, but I should at least have an opportunity to have a window into it. Or someone that I delegate to handle that for me, because I agree, I think a lot of people are saying users shouldn't be in charge of all of this by themselves. But there's a lot of things I don't know, and more importantly, I don't even know to ask. And I think Commissioner Slaughter made reference to this earlier, to the study that I think actually was in my home state of California, that a majority of Californians believed that if your website had a privacy policy, that meant they didn't share your data. So just the existence of a privacy policy somehow meant this entirely different thing. And so they didn't ask further questions because they didn't think they had to. And they're busy people and have other things to do. I don't think we can blame them for not being perfect privacy lawyers. And again, it's even more difficult for a consumer to assess risk. So for example, I might know a little bit about de-minimization, and I might know a little bit about anonymization, and I might think, oh, my data will be only shared anonymously, and that will be fine. Do I know anything about re-identification? Probably not, right? And as a consumer, I'm not in a very good position to assess that risk. But the company that's collecting my data probably is. And so when we talk about companies being transparent and talk about their responsibilities, I think that's part of the responsibility because they're best placed to know that. So anyway, if accountability is supposed to mean anything, it seems to me that's all of that information has to be available in clear language to me as a consumer or to the expert that I delegate. So what can the FTC do about this? This is one of the things that I was asked to address. And I think we're starting to overlap, so I'm going to be quick because I want us to have a time for a conversation. But right now, even before any additional work, it seems to me that FTC settlements could require much more rigorous audits and assessments that don't rely on management statements, but instead by careful investigation of actual practices in context. I think that assessments and audits should be made publicly available more than they are. There may need to be redactions, but that way, privacy scholars, for example, people who actually do police privacy and help keep consumers informed, can do their work in a much more effective way. And I think that privacy policies are terrible in many, many ways, but I do think that part of what they could include would be clear language about the actual risks to consumers so that they know what they're getting into. But I would suggest that we need to go far further than that. There should be some additional mechanisms that go beyond the FTC. So I would like to see really robust whistleblower protections so that people within companies who have a window into what's going on feel more comfortable and safer letting the FTC or other regulators know or other lawmakers know. Because really, it's the people on the inside that really understand how the data is being handled, and it's not always easy for someone from the outside to do that. I think I've heard a couple people suggest this. I do think we should have a private right of action. So for privacy harms, and that relates to transparency, because one of the things that happens when you have a class action lawsuit is you have discovery and you have investigations and you have lawyers who are empowered and interested in really digging into what the company is doing. And we don't have to dig into the preemption debate too deeply, but I do think that for now, we really want a situation where there's lots of different regulators, like attorneys general, state attorneys general, who are empowered to do the kinds of investigations that we need to have real transparency and real accountability. Now, the final thing I would just note, though, about transparency in particular, is that I'll just state the obvious. Transparency is great, but this is low-hanging fruit. Right? Transparency is just your starter point. And all the knowledge in the world isn't really that useful to me if there's nothing I can do about it. So that's sort of, we have to keep building in, and that's why I think flexible rules and flexible procedures are very, very important, but they need to be meaningful. They need to be real sticks and not just carrots.
Okay. Would anyone else like to jump in on the transparency issue or anything that Karen put on the table as well, as far as what we may want to see in legislation as far as transparency or accountability goes?
So there is a concept that was brought up this morning that's a very important concept, and that is the concept of setting parameters for what are legitimate uses of data. And the fact is that part of establishing an accountability program is actually as part of your assessment saying that you're within that range of legitimate uses. For those who know the GDPR, we're talking about the specification of legal basis to process we find similar in the Brazilian legislation that recently passed. We would find similar in Argentina when they pass their new legislation. But that is by specifying that, we still give flexibility to the organization, but we give some parameters around what is an appropriate use of data.
Yeah, I agree with almost everything that Corinne said. I think the point about audits is incredibly important. The FTC says in almost all of its consent decrees that there'll be an audit, and it'll be every 2 years under the life of the consent decree. But right now, they're not even real audits. They're assessments that are based in large part on executive statements in regards to the questions that are asked. And I've read them. I've read these redacted ones as part of my research, and they quite literally say things like, the requirement is that you are complying with the 2011, with Section 4B of the 2000 whatever consent decree, and then it says, please see Exhibit I, and Exhibit I is simply an executive statement that they are complying with Section 4 whatever of the consent decree. And that's not an audit. That is just an attempt to create a smokescreen with no substance behind it. So if the FTC is really committed to making its enforcement powers all that it can be, that doesn't even require legislation. The FTC should just take seriously the powers that it does have.
So transparency is, I think in this context so far has been discussed as a very positive thing. One could take the privacy policies that various folks already pointed out some of the issues with that, Commissioner Slaughter in her opening remarks. But I'm not sure that I'm quite ready to declare it dead. So Mike, I was wondering if you could, you have, I think, written about some of the benefits of a privacy policy. I wonder if you can give us some of your thoughts on why maybe they're not completely worthless.
Yeah, I would go even farther than that.
All right, excellent.
I have written on that. I wrote a paper a couple years ago called In Defense of the Long Privacy Policy. And, privacy policies are maligned and criticized all the time. People criticize them for being too long. There was this famous study about 10 years ago that said that if consumers had to read every privacy policy that they encountered over the course of a year, it would take 244 hours. We heard this morning that privacy policies have only increased in the last several years in terms of length. A lot of this is tied into that general criticism about the inadequacy of notice and choice as kind of the foundation for privacy regulation. Lots of criticism that many privacy policies, not the ones I've written, of course, are confusing and opaque. I think you referred to them as complete garbage. And certainly there's some truth to that. You can find examples of very bad privacy policies out there, very bad privacy statements. And as a result, consumers generally don't read them. I think that's undebatable. Most consumers don't read every privacy policy they come across. But nevertheless, I think they're very, very useful in creating accountability for a couple of reasons. One, particularly if we can get away from this pressure on companies to make privacy policies short and simple. I think that's a really misguided pressure to put on companies, because if they are detailed, if companies are forced to disclose or encouraged or incentivized to disclose detailed information about what they're doing, the mere process of creating that document creates accountability. It forces companies to do data mapping, to do privacy reviews, to understand what data they're collecting. And putting in place those processes inside of an organization can be incredibly useful. Similar to other mechanisms that we're seeing in privacy laws, like under the GDPR, we've got the Article 30 record keeping requirements and the requirements to create data protection impact assessments for high-risk data processing scenarios. Just that act of reviewing and documenting these practices can be incredibly useful. And the fact with a privacy statement that you have to post it publicly. It creates that second step of pausing and saying, is this a story I want to tell? And if it's not, it encourages companies to adopt new mitigation strategies, to maybe improve their privacy practices in other ways so that they have a more complete positive story that they can put out there. And the fact that consumers rarely read these things, I think, is not a fatal flaw. necessarily. There are other entities out there that do, that can act as proxies for the consumers and put real pressure on companies more so than an individual consumer can. And these are regulators and policymakers that might read them, academics and researchers, privacy activists, journalists. Investors are increasingly reading these for startups that might be acquired or that they want to invest in. And plaintiffs' lawyers, obviously, are reading these as well. And all of those actors have an ability to put pressure on companies to improve their privacy practices. So I think that creates absolutely real accountability. But this only works if privacy statements are detailed. And you look at a lot of the other proposals that are out there to make privacy statements shorter or simpler, whether they're for nutrition label approaches or icons or other approaches to privacy statement. I think those all fall short in this goal of creating accountability. Those who are pushing them have this idea that privacy can be reduced to these binary choices or very simplified facts, and that's just not the reality of most environments where privacy is an issue. You know, if we're looking at sort of a binary choice, is data shared with a third party? Well, that's not very interesting to me. What's interesting is what types of parties is it shared with, for what purposes, and what protections are in place around that. Every time companies are sharing data with each other, at least every time I've been involved with, there's a contract there, and those contracts sets out privacy and security obligations and restrictions on data use. And those are the facts that are interesting. Those are the facts that create sort of the real, whether there's a risk here or whether it's not, whether it's inappropriate or whether it's beneficial or whether it's harmful. And so if we try to simplify and shorten these things, it's just not going to create that kind of accountability. It's not going to create that kind of transparency that fosters accountability. So I'll stop there.
So I would be shocked if folks didn't have some comments that they wanted to add to that. So let's open it up to...
Yeah, I respect Mike and his work quite a bit, but I just think that's wrong. I mean, certainly there is a value to stating your policies, but just as Corinne said, you know, transparency is important, but it's not the be-all and end-all. I would say that we ask too much of transparency and privacy policies. We expect that they provide us with the ability to make rational choices. There's nothing that suggests that we can't have one privacy policy that's long and detailed for regulators and other tools, not necessarily a privacy policy, maybe it's visceral reactions or other things, that actually do tell users what's going on in a more acceptable or in a more psychologically driven way.
And to be clear, Ari, I'm not claiming that a long privacy policy is the be-all and end-all, and I absolutely agree with you that there are better ways and other ways to supplement that are more focused on the consumer. Just-in-time notices, contextual notices, design factors. I think all of those are super important, but unless you also have the very detailed privacy statement, I think you don't create that level of accountability, because the contextual stuff is fantastic, but if you ever want to go back and figure out what the whole story is, it's often very hard to recreate that context and find that information again. So again, the privacy notice may have another benefit of like being the one place you can go back to. You know, say when you agreed or you went through a sign-up process, you didn't have a particular sensitivity, and then something changed in your life and you did. It's hard to go back and go through that sign-up process again to figure out those choices you made or what you were thinking when you decided to use that product. But having a long, detailed privacy statement will have that information there. And I should have also pointed out, I meant to point out, that having it long is no excuse for crappy design. Right? Things like layering and things like writing clearly, avoiding legalese, all that stuff is important. People should be able to find the information that's relevant to them when they need that information. And I think a privacy statement can foster that, but it's not the whole answer, and it shouldn't be done by itself.
Well, I certainly respect that, and I agree. I think that the long privacy policy has been used by companies, however, to absolve themselves of responsibility. So my concern would only be with, I don't think we need to get rid of them. Fine, they're there. But my concern would be perpetuating the ability of technology companies to use them. Of course, in the ideal world, they would be a whole lot better, as you say, but perpetuating them as a a false operation where companies are allowed to get away with everything because they know that no one's actually going to read that narrative.
So this isn't about the length. This is about what is in there. And I just want to briefly say that I actually think going forward, when we use information beyond people's common understanding, we should actually be talking about our values and judge us on our values, and that should be part of what we're judged on. So I'm actually seeing longer, but that isn't about what's transparent to easily understand by the individual. It's part of the description of what you should be judged on. I'll just be quiet from there. And
would you like to add something, Karen?
Yeah, I think to some extent, you know, everybody is right here. I think we need both. I think we need the long policies for some of the reasons that Mike talked about, and Ari, for some of the reasons that you talked about. We also have to figure out ways to give our customers the information that's the most important to them. The problem is that's sometimes challenging. Mike gave the example about sharing. Right? I think all companies share information with third parties, right? You have to do that for all sorts of reasons. And so figuring out how to explain the aspects of that that customers are most interested in is really what companies like mine have to figure out. And you're never going to be able to do it for all of your customers and to satisfy each of their needs, because some customers are going to have different views on it. But at least if you can figure out what's most important to most of them and try to highlight that, I think that should be our goal.
Thanks. Anyone else, Corinne?
So this might be a place to interject something that I think is kind of complicated here. I mean, I think that a lot of times when we're talking about privacy in this context, we're thinking of really straightforward or consumer privacy, someone collecting information about what I buy. And we lose sight a little bit of that privacy means a lot of different kinds of things that overlap. And I wonder if we, as we think about privacy policies, one of the things I think where they fail is they're not particularly good at grasping that and communicating that. And so just to give an example, so I might have a privacy policy that tells me, you know, your data, this is the kind of data that we're going to collect about you, and here's how we handle it. And I say, okay, but I'm just thinking of that, and the company assumes I'm just thinking of that in terms of advertising and marketing. And maybe I don't realize that this database can also be targeted by law enforcement, or maybe I don't realize that this database can also, if I'm in, I don't know, a messy divorce, that there might be a subpoena for my information in connection with that. So I'm just sort of throwing a wrench in the whole thing, but I do think that as we're thinking about privacy and accountability, one of the things that we have to be put on the table is understanding that privacy means a lot of different things, and we don't always unpack that as we're trying to think about consumer risk, for example. So I just want to put that on the table.
And that's actually a good segue. Want to move to Dan, who's been a shrinking violet on this panel, strangely, but get you involved in draw you out a little bit, draw you into this conversation, and speaking of this is something you've thought about in the context of risk management and informational injury. So, you know, the idea that privacy means different things to different people. We talked a little bit about this, was discussed on the panel I moderated yesterday and some other panels, this notion of informational injuries, that there are certainly some things we care more about than others, and it's baked into at least the U.S. law with children and health and so on versus broad commercial data security under Section 5. Can you talk a little bit about how accountability mechanisms work in this context in with respect to risk management?
Sure, and thanks, James and Andrew, and thanks to the FTC for including me. As as Marty mentioned at the beginning, and Marcus Heider mentioned yesterday very eloquently, there are many accountability mechanisms to manage risk, and there seems to be a consensus on the broad contours of privacy accountability, the acceptance of responsibility for privacy protections, the ability to demonstrate that privacy promises are being met, effective governance that ensures an organization has the proper focus and resources to meet its privacy promises, and of course, compliance with law and regulation. There's also a recognition that the use of risk management, that those approaches provide a sound foundation for developing accountability. Privacy professionals are now well-versed in many of these risk management concepts through the important work done by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, NTIA, the Office of Management and Budget, and of course the FTC. Some of the more well-known risk management concepts include organizational governance structures, such as the appointment of a chief privacy officer, the development of policies and procedures, the application and monitoring of privacy controls, and workforce training and education. These risk management tools are necessary for an accountable privacy compliance program, whether it's internally created to meet privacy promises, made to consumers or through government regulation, but they are not sufficient for a mature risk management program. So why are they not sufficient? Too many risk management programs generally, and privacy risk management programs in particular, do not employ the tools necessary for thinking about emerging risk. That is, risks that may not be recognized today, but may well become a reality in the foreseeable future. Why is it then that risk management programs tend to be limited to current risk, especially compliance risk? Well, the simple answer is because thinking about the future is hard. There are tools, however, that can help and should be part of any risk management program for accountability. These tools have been tested in national security, corporate strategic planning, and product development. They include scenario development and analysis, wargaming, and design thinking. Are these tools a crystal ball in the future? No. But they do help organizations overcome biases to imagine the possible futures in which they must operate, and they help break down communication barriers between organizational functions and silos in order to plan for emerging risk effectively. So I think accountability for privacy management, for a privacy management program to be fully accountable, it must not only ensure that it meets current compliance requirements, but it also must take into account the potential future impacts it has on privacy and society.
So there have been a number of really interesting questions that folks have brought up, and unfortunately we don't have all afternoon, though maybe we'll take a little extra time. Nobody minds. Probably won't work out. But there are a couple questions that I would like to raise. One is one that I think is kind of lurking behind all this, but we haven't really addressed it directly, and I would like to get the panelists' input on this. You know, we've been talking about the responsibilities, additional responsibilities that we think that firms should take on here. I wonder if the panelists could address questions of cost, and down as an economist, I have to bring this up, of course, it's in my contract. I wonder if the panelists could bring up what are the potential downsides of this sort of regime? Are there none? Is this really sort of a everybody wins sort of situation? And if it is, kind of why isn't it more widespread? You know, why are we having this conversation about the requirement of these of accountability and just sort of saying, well, you know, it's all good, people are doing it. So I'll open this up to everyone. But, Marty?
So bright line rules that say you can't use data because we're afraid of the outcomes that come from that data, and we see some of that in the GDPR, is much more costly because that restricts our ability to create new concepts, new ideas, new insights, new ways of creating value. So yes, having the operational elements of accountability in your organization has expense. It is much cheaper than giving up discovery of new ideas, new concepts, new knowledge that will then drive innovation. So this is much cheaper than bright line rules.
Dan? So a couple of thoughts, Andrew. And this is sort of thinking, you know, at the senior corporate level. I think it's important for the FTC and for companies to think of data as an asset, number one. Number two, when you think about accountability, as I mentioned, that good risk management is not just about being compliant. That accountability tends to be a very good mechanism for looking backward, but we need to think of ways to creatively to think of it as we go forward. And then three, I think, you know, we need to figure out ways or examine ways to incentivize organizations to mitigate the risk of harmful uses or exposure to personal data. And we had a whole panel yesterday on de-identification. So I think that's a fruitful area.
I would say, of course, there's costs. It takes time and personnel and resources to put these kinds of measures in place. But it pales in comparison, not just to the opportunity costs that Marty talked about, but to the costs of a privacy screw-up. I mean, once something goes wrong, the cost of dealing with that reactively is orders of magnitude greater than the proactive approach.
The other kind of cost I'd like to mention is when laws aren't clear or when we get interpretations of laws sort of too late, becomes very challenging for companies to implement them, or they go down one path, or they spend a lot of time churning about one path, and then there has to be a switch. So some kind of clarity is important, and interpretations in enough time to be able to implement.
Here are the kind of arguments that Mr. Abrams made earlier about how costs, some of the costs are in generation of new ideas and innovation. I think this whole conversation yesterday began with a presentation about how there were costs to innovation from privacy restrictions. There are tons of studies that demonstrate that that's not the case, that privacy regulation does not stifle innovation. There's a new paper by Catherine Strandberg coming out. There are papers each year from behavioral economists that show that there is no binary choice between privacy rules and innovation and generative ideas. So I would caution us from being so taking that as an assumption, because even in the neoclassical model, what regulation is supposed to do is guide innovation, guide new ideas and new opportunities, and guide opportunities to fill demand based on the values that society highlights.
So I'm not trying to suggest that you'd forget privacy, but anybody who's working with trying to make research work in the European context today knows what I mean about the lack of ability to free up data for data-driven research because the rules are just designed not competently. So you can cite the research, I can cite the real on-the-ground results in Europe today.
In a couple minutes we have left, I wanted to get a good question from the audience. The idea here is that the notion of accountability, we've heard a lot about sort of internal processes, but does accountability in any way, and this touches on, I think, something that Ari discussed about, it's related to the idea of maybe an information fiduciary or a fiduciary relationship. Does accountability embrace the notion that you should safeguard data, use it in ways that doesn't cause harm? And how would we think about what those harms would be? Anyone?
I think it's important to not see, for regulators and the law, to create this idea in our consciousness that data is not merely an asset. Data is a responsibility. To suggest that data is just an asset means that we can buy and sell it, we can do pretty much whatever we want, subject to small limitations. But given the way and the importance in which data flows have to our interactions with each other today and basic human flourishing, having data, using it, wanting to make money off the amount of data that you have and wanting to make use of the data that you collect is a responsibility. And the way to recognize that is to impose fiduciary-like obligations on companies that ensure that you're not using that data in a way that harm, at a minimum, ensures you're not using it in ways that harm customers or consumers so you can benefit yourself.
Dan, do you want to jump in?
So part of this reminds me of the conversation we were having yesterday about GDPR and the 4% fine for global turnover. And it was said that, you know, that's gotten the attention of the C-suite. Well, I would agree with that, but I would argue to this point, you know, in the wrong sense. So what we're trying to do when we're talking about valuing data is getting companies, and in terms of risk management, getting companies to think about privacy strategically. And so the idea of a lot of prescription and fiduciary responsibilities, that we run the risk of having the same problem that we have with GDPR, which is this becomes operational control, and it becomes a compliance cost, and it goes way down in the bowels of the organization, and you know the company just sees it as a cost. So I think we've really got to flip it and see it as a see data and privacy as a value.
Okay. So I'll let you have a real quick, but we have triple zeros. So
okay, just a final thing. I think the idea of information fiduciaries has a lot of value to it, as long as we don't assume that that's going to cover all the bases. We're going to need more than that concept, it seems to me, to ultimately protect consumer privacy. What I like about it is I do think it encourages thinking about information and thinking about data as something more than an asset, but rather something that's actually important information about a person that they may care deeply about having shared or not shared.
Well, thanks. It's going to have to be the last word. Join me in thanking our panelists for this great discussion, and we'll be back in 15 minutes.